This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room and we get briefed. So if you really want to know what's going on in the world, then do listen and subscribe to this podcast. And please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. If you're minded to do so, please recommend us to your friends or your enemies, your family, anyone really. This week, I'm trying to understand what we now know about Russian intervention in other countries. If you enjoy this podcast, you might also like other BBC podcasts, such as The Inquiry.
I have a very simple message for Russia. We know what you are doing, and you will not succeed.
You know, all of this has been invented.
Theresa May last month, Vladimir Putin this morning.
What's so extraordinary about all this? And why does it have to be turned into a spy fever? Did you see what came out of the social media investigation? The ads put up by our companies account for much less than 1%, whereas American companies' ads account for 100% or 200% or 300%. Still, they think our ads are excessive. This is delirious. And the same applies to our media. What about freedom of the press? The very cornerstone, or one of the cornerstones, of American democracy. We have to learn from this and move on, instead of jumping at each other like some small animals do.
Small animals or not, Russian interference in Western politics has been a big part of the news for at least a year. Hardly a week goes by without some fresh twist on the story. But how much of what we think we know is hard fact, and how much is speculation or even conspiracy theory? That's what The Briefing Room is for. Step inside. First, the BBC's security correspondent, Gordon Carrera, is here in The Briefing Room to take us through what we know and don't know so far.
The evidence for Russian activity comes from a number of different countries, and it's different in each country. If you look at it, it's almost as if the Russians have a toolkit, and they've picked different tools and used them in different ways in different countries. The clearest evidence is in the United States. That's been studied by the US intelligence community, which did a report on it. It pointed to a range of activity, including the hacking of email accounts and of servers belonging to the Democratic Party, and then the release of some of that information which was damaging through WikiLeaks and through other platforms. In the US, there's also been the claim that social media companies were used by having automated accounts, so-called bots, which would push out messages. Also, the buying of adverts on Facebook to reach certain groups and push out certain messages, and the use of what you might call traditional rather than social media platforms, things like RT, Russia Today and Sputnik, to push out certain messages. So that was the kind of widest pattern of behaviour which was alleged to have been seen in the US. In other countries, you've seen different things. So if you take France, for instance, in the election there, the Macron campaign had its emails hacked and then released a few days before the election, never definitively proved to be Russian, but always suggested that that was the case, and that was amplified then by some social media accounts, but with less impact than in the United States. It was largely ignored by the French media. If you look at Germany, what you see is some evidence that these automated accounts on social media were pushing out messages linked to AfD, the far-right party. There have also been allegations in some countries of funds, perhaps, or other forms of support for certain parties. In the UK, The evidence is perhaps more limited so far. A lot of the investigations have centred on the Brexit vote. Now, here, there do appear to have been some of the same Twitter accounts active in the US election, which also tweeted around the time of Brexit. But it doesn't look like there were that many accounts. And just in the last couple of days, Facebook has said that it investigated whether there was any activity on its site in terms of ads. And it said it only found three adverts, which cost less than a dollar, so about 75 pence. So it's saying that it didn't see much activity in the UK in terms of social media, although the chairman of the Select Committee, Damian Collins MP, who's investigating this, said he's not very happy with that answer. Certainly we didn't see any hacking and leaking in the UK of emails, for instance, that we saw in the US. So you do see different types of activity in different countries over time. The thing about the American election is it was so close, and so it's plausible to come up with a scenario in which Russian interference may have made a difference. And certainly Hillary Clinton believes it did, although some might also think that's an excuse for her to blame it on an external factor and an external actor rather than on her own campaign decisions.
The Russians ran an extensive information war campaign against my campaign to influence voters in the election.
The issue for Donald Trump has always been that he has felt very insecure about the legitimacy of his election. That's partly because he didn't win the popular vote. And that, right from the start, has made him neuralgic about this claim that the Russians interfered and might have supported him, because he is already conscious of the questions over his mandate because of not winning the popular vote.
I think it was Russia, but I think it was probably other people and or countries. And I see nothing wrong with that statement. Nobody really knows.
There's been a bit of a debate about what the Russian strategy is. Are they trying to support certain candidates and outcomes, or are they just trying to create division and undermine the sense of cohesion in societies? In different cases, you can see different strategies. So in the US, I think the US intelligence community concluded that at one point they decided that they would back Trump and that they would try and damage Hillary Clinton. But also there's quite a lot of evidence that some of the messages, particularly on Facebook, were more about sowing discord, about trying to undermine any sense of cohesion. And you can see that in other countries as well, where it's less about supporting a political party. But sometimes they're even playing left and right. Sometimes they're focusing on divisive issues like immigration, particularly, and the claim that refugees are causing trouble in countries. And so there's a mix, I think, between a very targeted political activity to support candidates and a much wider sense of just trying to sow discord and undermine trust in institutions and in the centre ground. What we don't always know is how centrally directed this activity is in Moscow. Is it something that comes right from the top? That was suggested by the US intelligence community in late 2016 about the influence in the American election. It said they had a degree of confidence that it actually came from Vladimir Putin himself. But sometimes the strategies of Russia look quite chaotic, as if there's lots of different actors and no one's quite sure who's doing what. In terms of actually fighting back and going on the offensive, there's less sign of direct willingness to interfere with Russian elections, because I think there's a view that you don't necessarily want to go to your opponent's level and fight their game and delegitimize any democratic forces which are in those countries. For a long time, it didn't feel like the British government was looking very much at this problem, for whatever reason. But I think in the last few months, they've certainly woken up to the possibility of Russian interference, and Theresa May highlighted that last month.
Russia has fomented conflict in the Donbass, repeatedly violated the national airspace of several European countries, and mounted a sustained campaign of cyber espionage and disruption.
However, if you look at this from the Russian perspective, they view the West as having interfered in their politics for decades and having been consistently backing transparency groups, democracy groups, NGOs, having sponsored the so-called colour revolutions in neighbouring countries around Russia. And so the Kremlin certainly believes that there's been political interference by the West in its neighbourhood, at the very least, going back many years, and to some extent views what it's doing as simply payback for that.
Gordon Carrera. As Gordon suggested, the West is only just beginning to understand Kremlin interventions that attempt to shape our politics. Other countries on Russia's borders have dealt with it for longer. Anna Nemtsova is Moscow correspondent for The Daily Beast and Newsweek, and she's reported on this specific topic extensively and joined me from Moscow. I asked her for some examples of Russian activities in Europe.
I just returned from Prague, where people complain a lot about multiple Czech language websites that promote Putin. But I was mostly interested in the message. What message do they actually bring to Europe from Russia? So I asked them all the same question. What would be the Russian values? Every time I asked that question, the answer was immediately that Baltic countries, for instance, they are occupied by NATO. And NATO are all either homosexuals or there is some big problem with NATO. These reporters, they criticize the European values, European policy. Let me just tell you a story about what I heard in Germany, for instance. There was a big scandalous story about the girl called Lisa, who was allegedly raped by immigrants. And then it turned out that there was no rape story, that it was all fake. But hundreds of people came out in Germany right in front of Merkel's office. They were protesting for days. And that was shocking for many German liberals to see how many people react to that fake news. And they were also upset that Russian government, Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, who talked about our girl Lisa, never apologized about that fake news.
From your travels in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet bloc countries, would you say that the disruptive strategy, as you've outlined it, is working?
It is working. I meet a lot of supporters, apologists of Moscow policies. I see Putin's fans. I see towns already like Belgrade where people wear T-shirts with Vladimir Putin's face on them. But the question is, why is this happening? Why is a person from a provincial town in Hungary or a woman from a Czech town would be Putin's fan? And the answer is always because they have a lot of personal problems. They always blame the West. They always blame Europe, while there is this powerful, strong man who criticizes these European values. Therefore, he might be the right guy for them, and he might one day defend them.
Now, if we were to take the story that the Russians tell themselves about why this is necessary, how would that go?
Well, they basically blame the United States for aggression, for expanding NATO, for threatening Russia's security, for undermining Russia's growing economy by sanctions, and plotting step-by-step Cold War against Russia.
Anna Nemtsova, that tells us the what of Russian semi-covert operations in Europe and the West. But what about the whys, and indeed the what nexts? What is the Kremlin's strategic objective, and what risks is it running in pursuing them? In New York is Kimberly Martin, a professor at Barnard College, Columbia University, specialising in US-Russia relations. In Moscow, Andrei Soldatov, author of Red Web, which explores the relationship between Russian politics and the internet. And in London, Matthew Bouleg, research fellow at the Russia and Eurasia programme at the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House, all brought together in the briefing room. Well, we heard Gordon Carrera talk earlier about the hacking of US politicians' emails. Andrei, this is something you've investigated. Could you talk us through how it actually worked?
Well, it's a very complicated world of Russian digital and cyber operations. It's not very hierarchical, and it means that we do have security agencies and intelligence agencies very active in cyber, but also we have so-called informal actors, people and groups of people who are officially not affiliated with the government. But at the same time, they enjoy direct access to the Kremlin, and that makes them sometimes much more adventurous, flexible, and aggressive. than the secret services.
So there are all kinds of kind of freelance people who operate with the agreement of the Kremlin, but not directly at the behest.
Well, actually, they're directed by the Kremlin. So it's not like we do something and then we expect some reaction from the Kremlin. In most cases, it's directed by the Kremlin people, by the administration of the president.
Kimberly, how has this been experienced in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, it's been the major topic of news ever since it was first noticed, which I think was in summer of 2016. And it's sort of been dribbling out. But I think there are three things that we pretty much know at this point that the Russian intelligence agencies or their informal employees were responsible for. One was releasing the emails, as you mentioned. A second one was releasing an awful lot of fake advertisements on social media. And the third was actually trying to get into the equipment that were involved in the elections in 21 states, and then also the Florida manufacturer of the software and equipment that is used by the electoral systems throughout the country.
Now we talked a bit about the bots and so on. This last aspect, getting directly inside the electoral equipment, we've heard the accusation. I don't think people understood in Britain that this actually happened and what the consequence was.
The evidence that we have heard publicly is that the data was breached from who the voter rolls were, but that no actual votes appear to have been changed. And there's sort of two guesses about what's going on. The first is that it was preparatory for the 2018 midterm elections that are coming up and that the Russian intelligence agencies will try this again. The second possibility is that if Hillary Clinton had won the election, there would have been an attempt to very carefully target advertisements and other kinds of social media communication that would suggest that the election was fraudulent in order to get people to try to demand that there be a recount.
So the motive actually has to be speculative. We know what happened, but we can't be absolutely certain, but that's what we think. Matthew, what's your analysis of how the Kremlin sees itself in relation to the West, which underpins these sorts of activities?
I think the first and basic underlying rationale we have to make is that Russia is at war against the West. I think it's important to say it, it's important to repeat it, nonetheless, for policymakers, that Russia is waging a war against the present international order. Short of sending tanks, of course, I'm talking about full spectrum warfare, from soft power destabilization, from cyber warfare, interference. These are measures short of hard power policy or hard power war that Russia is using against the international order and against the West. And
I don't agree.
Sorry, Kimberly.
Which is good.
Yeah, Kimberly.
Yes. I mean, there's no question that the Russian military and Russian intelligence agencies are waging what they call information war against the United States and against the West. But I wouldn't call that a full-scale war. It's not all that different from what Soviet intelligence agencies did, the KGB did, in terms of the same kinds of techniques. It's just that the internet and email and so forth makes it go a lot quicker and a lot more broadly. But there was always that kind of tension and those kinds of attempts at tactical hits. I think that's not the same thing as a full-scale war, and I think thinking of it as a full-scale war is incredibly dangerous because there are ways that this could very much spiral out of control.
I think, Matthew, Matthew, was your point rather that they see it as a war, not that we would regard it as the kind of war we call war?
Exactly. It's a question of perceptions, and there is this siege mentality or fortress mentality that has taken over in the Kremlin at the moment, and they are projecting their insecurities onto us, just as much as Russian attempts at destabilizing our democracies are an image of our own insecurities. So in that sense, it's a question of failed perceptions, and as Kimberly put it, it is potentially spiraling out of control, and the risk for tactical errors and miscalculations is increasing.
Right. To characterize it for the moment, though, Anna Nemtsova earlier suggested that the Russians see themselves essentially in a continuation of the Cold War. Kimberly, is that how you see it?
Yes. And I think that putting it in terms of the Cold War gets at very much the message that Putin is trying to get across, which is that Russia is a great power. It is back. People have to pay attention to it. And he would like us to think of Russia as being as powerful as the United States is in terms of being a what we might call a pole in the international system. He talks about the multipolar world. And he would like us to believe that China is a rising pole, that Russia is back as a pole, and that both are challenging the United States pole.
What I think the listener might have difficulty is what all this is actually for. Firstly, let's state a danger here. If you are successful in your disruption in the West, you could quite conceivably create leaderships, populist leaderships, who end up being even more antagonistic towards countries like Russia. Matthew.
Putin thrives and Russia presently thrives at what they call the piloted chaos, which is an international order whereby they can advocate for quote-unquote spheres of influence or the acknowledgement that Russia has a particular edge in its periphery or in its borders. And it would be better, according to Russia, to be surrounded by potentially threatening powers that they could control rather than democracies, especially, when it comes to the expansion of NATO in its neighborhood. So in this sense, Russia would thrive even more at a more chaotic environment than the environment of the liberal order that we presently have. Well, and that is cracking.
That's funny, Kimberly, because going back into my kind of ancient past, we always used to regard the Russians as being essentially very conservative and wanting certainty. And this picture of what Matthew's called piloted chaos, which may be the phrase of the day, is not at all like that.
Well, I would disagree with Matthew in the sense that I don't think it's Russia that's doing this. I think it's Putin and his friends in the Kremlin that are doing it. And I think we have to separate out what's happening in Russian domestic politics from what Russia as a whole gets benefit from. This is all being done for domestic political reasons. It's a way for Putin to demonstrate his strength to ensure that he gets reelected in 2018. And then going forward, sort of makes this his contribution to Russian history, that he made Russia a great power again that was taken seriously by the rest of the world and disrupted the West. But I think that there are many people in Russia who do not believe that disruption of the Western world is in Russian interests. And there are people who don't agree with Putin, including within the Kremlin.
And that's an excellent moment to bring in Andre. Andre, how does this all look to most ordinary Russians? I mean, if it is Putin's calculation that it will help him, is his calculation right?
Well, I think that for ordinary Russians, the idea that the Americans are so stupid and they blame us for everything has some... Well, actually, it's a good... It's a very pleasing thought, because on the one hand, you can say, well, the Americans are stupid. At the same time, you might feel that you are back on the world stage. You are so powerful, your country and your leader is so powerful that in almost every political crisis all over the world, you have the Russians to blame. Which is, as I said, a very pleasing thought.
Really? It doesn't feel like a diversion from the ordinary day-to-day needs of Russians?
Well, the thing is that after the annexation of Crimea, the idea that we need to get back and to be much more represented on the world stage is a very powerful thought for many, and we should understand it's not only about people in regions not very educated, it's also about the middle classes. They also need some meaning. And Putin gave them this meaning. It worked pretty well for 2 and maybe 3 years. Maybe now people got tired, but still this feeling is there.
Matthew Buleg, where do you think the Russian attitude towards the West currently comes from?
I think this form of attitude that we see in the Kremlin at the moment stems from this sense of humiliation that arose from the end of the Cold War. And to paraphrase President Putin, who called the dissolution of the Soviet Union the single biggest historical catastrophe in the world, I think this was the most misquoted and misunderstood statement in the world, because we really have to put ourselves for this once in the shoes of the Russians, and especially the leadership that arose from the 1990s, 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and 1998 with a very strong financial crisis that affected most Russians. There was a sense that Russia lost its heart, lost itself in the corridors of history, and was humiliated into losing its place as a great power projecting itself onto the world. And we have now seen a resolutely more offensive Russia trying to find back that place.
Kimberly, there's been an element in this discussion, I think, over here that has almost seen Vladimir Putin as a kind of Bond villain with all the cards, you know, kind of devilishly clever. Everything he does is interpreted as being effective and so on. Does that narrative play against him or for him, do you think?
Oh, I think that plays very much for him. I think, as Andre pointed out, the general Russian population is really happy at the idea of being back again and doesn't seem to mind the reputation of being a disruptive force.
If you look at that press conference this morning that we began the program with, it seemed to be of a man who is utterly and supremely confident, and confident also that he won't be contradicted.
Well, it's really important for any leader in the kind of system that Russia has, in what people call a patron-client system, where everything depends on you having a degree of confidence that the person who's above you in the hierarchy will give you what you need, will support you, and in turn, you have the obligation to support them. It's really, really important to project strength, because if anybody started believing that President Putin was not capable of keeping his group in power, if he were not capable of keeping stability in the country, essentially the wolves would come out and everybody would start trying to take their place as the person who could have the new network leadership that would replace Putin.
Matthew, what do you think the Kremlin calculation is about how the West would respond to all this once it's discovered?
Well, I think if we look at the problem differently, I think Russia is today an afterimage of our own insecurities in the world. Because of our inability to protect ourselves efficiently, and you can't really blame the Russians for probing the cracks in the system and for probing our mentalities and trying to win the hearts and minds of the populations. And these messages sent by the Kremlin over, and if you can see the RT ads in the London Tube or the foreign meddling in the US or in France, these things work to a certain extent. And some populations were ready to change their point of view and change their perspective because the Russian propaganda is slowly trickling in. And this is not just Russian propaganda. It's a world vision that they're projecting. So as RT would say it, you know, go blame the Russians.
So, Andre, you think that the Kremlin is pretty happy about what it's accomplished so far? It's not worried about the fact that everybody is talking about it and, if you like, it's all been discovered?
No, actually, quite the opposite. Actually, people in the Kremlin are very confused. Well, and actually, it started right after the election, and nobody expected Trump to win. The idea was to weaken Hillary Clinton, and it was a big surprise for everybody. So it's a big problem now for many people in the Kremlin, how actually, what to do after the election, how to talk to Trump's people. And some people at the foreign ministry told me that actually we will be more happy with Hillary because it would be much more predictable.
No, it's sorry, if you hear a kind of slight laughter in my voice, it's because they knew how to undermine Hillary, if you like, but they have no idea how to undermine somebody like Trump. What, Kimberly, should the West be doing about this now? How should we respond?
Well, I'm really disappointed that what the United States Congress is doing is pushing more and more sanctions against Russia. The focus of U.S. foreign policy at the moment seems to be completely on punishing Russia. And that's why I think this image of being at war with Russia is dangerous, when, in fact, what we should be doing is the same thing we did during the Cold War, is looking for ways that around the edges of what we know is a conflict, we try to find ways to make that conflict less strong, to try to find areas not for overall cooperation, but for making the conflict less dangerous. It is recognizing that there is really very little that the United States can do to effectively punish Russia in the sense of getting Russia to change its behavior. We put on more and more sanctions, and yet we don't see Russian behavior changing as a result. People in the United States believe that Russia will try to interfere in the 2018 midterm elections. There's no sense that the sanctions against Russia have stopped that. We can't get into a cyber war with Russia, even though the U.S. has very good offensive cyber capabilities, because if that were to happen, the U.S. is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world to cyber conflict. We have so many civilian things connected to the internet, ranging from self-driving cars to heart pacemakers. And we've seen elsewhere in the world that the Russian state is not the least bit concerned about protecting civilians. And so if we were to get into an all-out cyber conflict with Russia, we'd lose.
Thank you. Also, to try and summarize that, the Russians have indeed been seeking to create what we've heard described as piloted chaos in the West. To a certain extent, they've succeeded, and it's an activity they're probably not going to give up unless either A, we make love to them, or B, make war. It's our choice. My thanks to Gordon Carrera, Kimberly Martin, Andrei Soldatov, Matthew Bourleg, and Anna Nemtsova. We'll be back next week. Good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider.
Hello. Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.